Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today on the program, we commemorate two famous flights. One of them put a man on the moon 50 years ago, and the other involved a tragic airplane crash at the Sioux Gateway Airport 30 years ago. We'll take a look at the crash of United Flight 232 and hear from some Siouxlanders who were there during and after the event. One of them was Dr. Quentin Durwood, neurosurgeon with CNOS, who will talk about the life-saving work done by medical professionals on that tragic day.
The remarkable series of events that turned something which could have been far more disastrous, and it was a disaster. I mean, there's about 100 people killed, as I recall. It was a terrible disaster, but it could have been much worse.
We'll hear more from Dr. Quentin Durwood in a few minutes. But first, how the moon landing changed the world on July 20th, 1969. American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin became the first humans ever to land on the moon. About 6.5 hours later, Armstrong became the first person to walk on the moon. The Apollo 11 mission took place 8 years after President John F. Kennedy announced a national goal of landing a man on the moon by the end of the 1960s. This Saturday night, people all over the world will commemorate the moon landing. Here in Siouxland, there are several special programs that will illuminate and educate you about that event. Dr. Todd Young became well known to Siouxland residents 2 years ago with his many programs about the solar eclipse. The Wayne State College Professor of Physics and Astronomy is the director of the Fred G. Dale Planetarium at Wayne State College. This Saturday, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, Young will present the program Apollo 11, Man's First Steps on the Moon, and One Small Step, Apollo 11 and the Future of Space Exploration. I talked with Young about the importance of the moon landing 50 years ago.
This is one of those moments in history where I think if you're old enough to have watched it on TV and you can remember it, you know, you remember the day, you remember where you were, you know, and it's one of those, you know, those, you know, and it's what's even more great is that it's one of those positive things, you know. Usually you remember where you were with the negative ones, you know, 9/11 and the assassination of President Kennedy and stuff like that. But here was, you know, this is just mankind venturing, you know, out into an unknown, you know, and everybody's on the edge of their seat, and it's not a Netflix show. I mean, this was real life, and this was real dangers, you know, being presented live to everybody across the world, you know. And I mean, it was just an amazing thing, you know. And for it to happen without disaster, I mean, all the better, you know. But this event, I think, really sparked a lot of people to get into astronomy and science and start to think of themselves, you know, on a planet that's in a solar system, that's in a galaxy, you know, so that we're both, you know, it reminds us our place in the universe, but it also reminds us about how marvelous we are and that we can be even begin to venture and think about what's going on out there. You know, and we really need that to continue, because we get so much out of making ourselves think like that and go there, you know. And you know, and so I'm hoping that this 50th anniversary kind of reignites a spark to maybe going back to the moon, and then of course continuing forward with all plans of going to Mars, you know, because it's really when you put yourself out there in those dangerous situations that, you know, that's the mother of invention, as it were. You know, how are we going to survive? How could we possibly thrive? You know, how could we do this? How could we do that? You know, and in figuring that out and experiencing those experiences is where we do a lot of learning, a lot of growing, you know, across the world.
Do you think that some people feel today, from what I've heard, that the space program, space travel, all of that takes money away from other scientific needs? And they say, well, what do we get? What did we get out of the moon landing?
Well, then I guess my first thing to just I would say is, well, go to whatever search engine you want to use and type in benefits of space exploration. And they'll get their answer right there. the cell phones that everybody has right now, athletic shoes, baby food, really computers, GPS systems, all of these can be traced back to space exploration. I mean, all of these came out of the necessity of, well, how are we going to feed these astronauts? Speaking of baby food, how are we going to feed these astronauts when we have so limited space, right? And there's like really no refrigerator, you know, that they can just open up, that kind of thing, you know. So, I mean, there's so many technological and scientific benefits from trying to figure out how to, like I said, survive, thrive, and go someplace that's off Earth, and so someplace like that, that we reap those benefits, but we, at this point, a lot of people have forgotten. Without that trip to the moon and without that space race, we would probably be technologically, decades behind where we are right now.
So it really pushed people because they had to come up with answers. They had to fix these problems.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We had that, there was that horrible disaster with Apollo 11. I'm sorry, not Apollo 11, Apollo 1. And then even with the space shuttle disasters, they are disasters. We honor their courage, but we learn, right? And we learn from those mistakes, and that's where we progress even further. I mean, it's a dangerous thing, but yet we still have a spirit to say, well, we're going to learn from this, and we're going to rebuild, and we're going to do this again, and we really need to keep doing that. If we get too complacent, then we really begin to stagnate as a society, technologically and otherwise. Continuing to reach out is really the best thing that we can do.
I know here at the Planetarium you've had a lot of interest in recent years and in events, and you did a lot of shows and programs when the eclipse happened a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. It does seem like people are always interested in these things, whether it's an eclipse or a manned mission to space, to the moon, to Mars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, astronomy in these, yeah, it's like, you're right. It's usually a not too hard of a sell, as it were, when these kind of things come up, because I think just about everybody, there's no better view than a really good, clear, dark night sky. That's where, with today's cell phones and distractions and so forth, you put someone out in a field with a good dark sky, night sky, and they will be in awe, about everything that they can see, and it helps bring people back to remembering that they're on a planet in a wondrous universe, and that there's a lot of mystery that is yet to be solved in that universe, and it gets them thinking about all the stuff that we've done before and what could still be done, and it sparks their curiosities, and then hopefully they come to the Planetarium and learn more, and again, usually when these bigger events like this happen, they actually move on those curiosities and come visit, and I can help them out.
You were not born at the time of the moon landing, correct?
Well, no, I do have sort of a cosmic connection to all of this in that I was actually born on July 16th, 69, the day they blasted off for the moon. So technically I did watch the moon landing, but I don't remember it. So
that was Wayne State Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Dr. Todd Young. This Saturday, on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, Young will present two programs at the Fred G. Dale Planetarium: Apollo 11, Man's First Steps on the Moon, and One Small Step, Apollo 11 and the Future of Space Exploration. Those programs are free and open to the public at the Fred G. Dale Planetarium on the Wayne State campus. For schedules and times of those programs, go to wsc.edu/planetarium. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media, and we are remembering the first moon landing this week, 50 years ago. As we remember that anniversary, Siouxland Public Media helped produce a special segment with members of Girls Inc. Throughout the summer, a group of young ladies learn about reporting and radio through our Siouxland Public Media Lab. Three of those girls spent time at the Center for Active Generations in Siouxland to talk to seniors as they remember and reflect on this half-century milestone.
3, 2, 1.
Hi, I'm Adeline.
I'm Abby. And I'm Kaya.
And we're from Girls Inc.
And we're exploring the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Well, you have to tell me what year the moon landing happened. I can't remember the day.
1969.
Nails is Houston, Roger out.
My name is Linda Lee Diebler. And I was born in 1939.
What do you remember about that day?
That day. I loved history, and I thought that was wonderful that we landed on the moon, that Neil Armstrong was such a brave man to do that. How many people, men or women, would be brave enough to take that step? Because they didn't know if they were going to come back or not.
That's one small step for man.
My name is Dolores Disterhop. I was early 20s, and I probably was working on my farm in Minnesota.
Can you describe what you saw and the impact the event made on you?
That's a hard question to answer. I guess my whole thought was, why are we really exploring the moon? Do we really need that? Are we ever going to put human beings up there to live? And is it just a waste of our money? I guess I was just amazed that technology was so great that it could get a big thing like that up in the air. And also, I was just a little worried that maybe they wouldn't come back either. I think a lot of people were worried about that.
Here, men from the planet Earth, first set foot upon the moon, July 1969.
How old were you when the moon landing happened?
I was, at that time, about 21 years old. My name is Bob Steffi. I live here in Sioux City. I've been here for most of my life.
What do you remember about that day?
I do remember the excitement that it caused. Everyone was jubilant in the fact that we were experimenting mostly in a journey that was going to be far, far from the Earth, and I guess we were just excited about the whole thing. Actual event, of course, was televised, and that's what we were watching. As the journey progressed, we all got more and more excited as far as it getting closer and closer to the moon. And when, you know, it actually landed, it was kind of a cloud of dust, and you could see the parachute opening on its way down, and the capsule was intact. It wasn't in pieces, you know, so we knew that it was successful.
Although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it, it's almost like a powder.
Do you think more should be done when it comes to exploring outer space?
No. I'm sorry, I don't. I think more should be done to for the cure of diseases like cancer. I would prefer money spent there.
I like progress. At first I wasn't for it. I thought it was a waste of money, but we need to keep on pushing on and progressing farther and farther with all this.
I think space exploration is a good thing, and I think that at some point, in my opinion only, the Earth will probably wear out and we'll need a new habitat, so I think it's a good thing.
Well, for thousands of years now, it's been man's dream to walk on the moon. Right now, after seeing it happen, knowing that it happened, it still seems like a dream.
Can you believe it's been 50 years since the moon landing?
No, because my last birthday, when I turned 70, I couldn't believe I was 70 either. So,
you know, I'm 79 years old. It's hard for me to remember way back then. 69. That's a long time ago. I wish I'd been a history teacher.
Anything else you would like to say?
No, but I appreciate your interview. I think education is one of the most important things that you can do, and especially at your ages, because you're our future. You're what we look forward to.
That was 14-year-old Adeline and Abigail and Kaya, who are 12 years old. They're members of Girls Inc. and the Media Lab Project at Siouxland Public Media. Special thanks to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer for producing the interviews with seniors at the Center for Active Generations in Sioux City. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, we have been talking a lot today about the anniversary of the first man on the moon 50 years ago this week. However, there is another more haunting air travel anniversary this week for Siouxlanders. On July 19, 1989, 296 people were on board Flight 232 when it crashed at the Sioux Gateway Airport. 185 people survived because of the work of the flight crew and pilot Al Haynes. The response by rescue crews in Sioux City received worldwide attention, as well as getting an outpouring of support from the community. Mayor Bob Scott reflected on that day with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer.
We're coming up on the 30th anniversary. What kind of insight would you like to share with people about that day?
Well, you know, I tell people I remember that day. I was going to, I had gone to Omaha, and I came back that afternoon and saw like 50 ambulances parked out on the interstate. And of course, I'd been gone all day and didn't realize that there was a tragedy about to happen because they kept the ambulances out there because they couldn't bring them on until the plane actually landed. And so then I turned the radio on right away and learned that there was probably going to be a plane crash in our community, which was kind of unsettling, to tell you the truth.
You were on the city council at the time, and the outpouring of support from Sioux City, people still talk about it today.
Well, I mean, our citizens did what they always do, and that's come to the aid of their fellow man. And that day in particular, it was a day where you could be very proud if you were an elected official in this community, because our citizens showed up and did what needed to be done and tried to comfort. And they did it not only that day, but they did it in the weeks after that, tried to comfort families and do those sort of things that we do really well here in this community. So, but it was still, I mean, you know, not having anybody be involved in it, still you were sad just because there was that kind of loss in our community.
And it's still shocking that people actually survived if you look at the aftermath of what happened.
Yeah, I flew over the next day in a helicopter, and to believe that, you know, that many people survived in that kind of carnage was just difficult to understand. So, I mean, our first responders had to do a great job that particular day just because of the way that thing crashed and, the separated and all that sort of stuff. And fortunately we were close to hospitals and our hospitals were set up to handle that kind of thing. So it was just Sioux City at its best.
That was Siouxland Public Media Sheila Brummer talking with Mayor Bob Scott about the day Flight 232 crash landed at the Sioux Gateway Airport 30 years ago this week. And today does mark the 30th anniversary of the crash landing of Flight 232. The Mid-American Museum of Aviation and Transportation plans to host an open house as a day of remembrance. Here's Museum Director Larry Finley.
Hopefully it'll be a continuing period of healing for the people that were here, the medical community, the volunteers. Some of the survivors may even be back here for the open house here at the museum. We'll be open from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., and there will be free admission all day long here at the museum, so people can come in and see the regular displays here as well as the memorial area and the displays that we set up specifically for the 25th anniversary 5 years ago. We're not doing a big program, so to speak, like we did 5 years ago, because the crew members are, just like the rest of us, are 5 years older than we were at the 25th, and some of them are not able to travel anymore. So we decided that in cooperation with Susan White, who was a flight attendant on United Flight 232, she is having a open house meal type thing at her residence in Denver. Tomorrow, we will tie in with that group via Facebook and Skype so that the people out there, the survivors, crew members and stuff that are still in Denver, will be able to see people here in Sioux City. They'll also be able to see the 25th anniversary display. If they saw it 5 years ago, they'll see something different. We continue to update that display on a regular basis. And for those that have never been to Sioux City, they'll be able to see it for the first time as to what we've done to honor the memory of the 112 people that lost their lives in that crash, as well as the people that helped the survivors of that crash while they were recuperating here in Sioux City in subsequent days.
The museum, located near the Sioux Gateway Airport, also features a special display on the flight and the response to the crash landing.
In the Flight 232 area is Captain Haynes' seat. We have a 1/12 scale model of a DC-10, the type of aircraft that crashed here, which is a 14-foot wingspan of a McDonnell Douglas aircraft. We have two videos in the display area that recaps everything from a news director's viewpoint of the crash to the viewpoint of Gary Brown, who was the disaster services director, Jim Hathaway, who was the fire chief for the Air Guard at that time. Bob Hamilton was our fire chief for the city of Sioux City. All perspectives on video, as well as the disaster drill that we held 2 years earlier, in which we simulated a 200-passenger aircraft crash landing here at Sioux Gateway Airport. It was a disaster drill for emergency services, for the hospitals, for the doctors, and 200 victims, so that everybody could practice on how would we respond to a disaster like that. Little did we know in October of 1987, when we conducted this drill, that less than 2 years later, we would be doing the exact same thing for real with United Flight 232.
That was Larry Finley, the director of the Mid-American Museum of Aviation and Transportation. Again, the hours for today's open house are 10 a.m. until 7 p.m. As Flight 232 made its way to the Sioux City Airport, former television news anchor Dave Nixon Sr. reported on the crippled airliner from the ground. He shared his memories with Siouxland Public Media during our recent fund drive. Here's part of his conversation with Sheila Brummer and Steve Smith.
So many people died in a 45-minute period that at one point in the story, when we were covering the story, the Flight 232, as most people remember, had lost an engine over Storm Lake, and the pilots were, and Captain Haynes, the hero of that flight, was struggling to keep the plane flying, getting it over to Sioux City where it could have a runway to land on. Because when it first happened, the report on the radios, the police and fire radios, was that it may crash right out there east of Sioux City that far, because and we knew, if you've driven out east of Sioux City along Highway 20, you know that it's not a flat land, it's hilly. So it was frightening to be able to cover it in that regard. And I always wondered how I would emotionally stand up under something, you know, like the explosion of the Challenger or something. But having said that, so we started covering the story on the air and describing the things as they were happening. The plane was at least appeared to be in some control, because as it worked out, the crew had figured out how they could use the thrusters on both sides. When they were able to do that, big turns. So as they made these big looping turns, they were getting closer to the Sioux City Airport all the time. So you could hear the conversation with the control tower and Captain Haynes, what was going on. So we were in the studio, I mean, the people at the TV station at Channel 4 were answering phones and getting phone calls and so much drama going on. And I was just absolutely holding on to the anchor desk, hoping that I didn't lose my, composure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so as time went on, we were happy to hear the pilot telling the control tower he had a little control, and they could see the airport, and they were going to try to land it. And there was such a weird situation, kind of serendipitous humor at the time. And one of those points of humor was the control tower in Sioux City advised Captain Haynes that there was an interstate running right along the highway, and there was the runway that he could land on. And Captain Haynes said, replied, "Oh, well, you want me to land it on a runway?" So those were the moments. But the moment that affected me the most personally, like everyone else that was having anything to do with it, was when it looked like the plane was going to touch down okay, and then the right wing dipped down and hit the dirt and exploded, and just a massive ball of flame and smoke. Dave Boxham, one of our photographers.
He was an intern.
He was an intern.
At the time.
Yeah. He happened to be standing at the right place and had the right photo. The first time, we were told, it was the first time that video was done of a commercial plane crashing. So then that was, I mean, your heart was just in your throat. Not much was being said while everybody was watching the flames. And then I saw a helicopter coming up out of the smoke and concluded that they don't take dead people to the hospital, so somebody must have survived. And it's amazing how your human reaction to that is. I was gleeful that, you know, apparently somebody has survived that. Then we were finding out the next reports. Kathy Egan, one of the reporters, said, "Well, I don't know why they won't let us. They won't let us out near the crash site. You know, we're just not that far from the crash site. They won't let us there to interview anybody. And there are sightseers walking around there, around the crash site." It was the people who had walked out of the plane, had survived.
Wow.
The survivors. So anyway, those types of stories. So the next day I went out to the site and sat and ruminated on that and thought about what we had seen, and that was really difficult. So University of South Dakota psychological students conducted some PTSD, and that was early in those days.
Right when the term PTSD became familiar.
Yeah, matter of fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, Steve, because I don't know if that's what they call it, but I knew that University of South Dakota College of Education, they had a team that would go out to schools in traumatic situations and do that type of counseling. So they start doing it regularly in Sioux City for any of the first responders. So I attended, you know, a couple of those just to, you know, help me figure out all that stuff. And I'm grateful for it the rest of these days in my life, because we all have those days.
That was former TV news anchor Dave Nixon Sr., who reported on the crippled airliner of Flight 232 from the ground 30 years ago today. He shared his memories with Siouxland Public Media during our recent fun drive, and he talked with Sheila Brummer and Steve Smith. In this week leading up to the 30th anniversary of the crash of United Flight 232 at the Sioux City Airport, there have been a lot of stories told, informally, formally. Some of them were told yesterday at a special History at High Noon at the Sioux City Public Museum. More than 150 people gathered to talk about the crash and its aftermath with Matt Anderson. However, many of those at the program knew firsthand what happened that day. Some were first responders, some medical personnel, others were journalists, and yet others nearby farmers who saw bits of the plane fall into their fields. These people held the trauma of that day 30 years later. One of them, retired St. Luke's Hospital chaplain Steve Pullman, got to the heart of the matter with the story of one little boy.
One little boy, aged 6 years, asked me if he could tell me a secret. I replied, yes. He whispered, My mommy died in a plane crash, and I miss her a lot. As he cried, I cried. I wanted to pick him up and hold him, but I could not pick him up because he was in skeletal traction.
There are many stories told by those who saw the plane go down and helped with the survivors afterwards. One of them was Janet Flanagan, who now works for Bishop Heelan Catholic High School, who was then a nurse at St. Luke's.
People cannot forget. They can't stop talking. This, at the museum, this program is kind of like a support group still for some people, because it was not just a physical and an emergency reaction. It's a very emotional event for many, many people involved.
It does seem really cathartic, and I was surprised to hear the tears, and it just gets to people.
Well, what's amazing is the incredible Siouxland response, because you have people with stories at the airport. You have people with stories in the ambulances rushing from Mobile and all these surrounding towns. You have the hospital stories. You have the blood bank stories. This tragedy touched so many different people and so many different organizations. And we are proud that we responded. So I guess we're still remembering, and we're still celebrating. We're still grieving.
For some, like young Sherry Zehner-Keipel, the date was supposed to be a dull round of routine tasks, as she spent time as an intern with the Sioux City Journal, observing the work of firefighters and first responders. Did you see the plane come down?
I did. Yeah, I did. It was like just the ball of fire that from far, because we were further down, like by where the National Guard area is.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So we could just see the ball of, as he was talking about today, how it tipped, but you could just see fire. And all I could think was, I've just watched, you know, we knew there were about 300 people on board, and I just thought, I've just watched 300 people, you know, die. And then after the fire chief and his driver had to run up and start responding, and of course they told me I needed to stay inside, which as I look back now, I'm sure was a liability thing, but I've never felt so helpless in my life, because I watched people come out of the cornfield, and it was... and I watched all of the response that was happening, and then, I had my window down. It was hot in the middle of the summer, and I had people ask, you know, for water, for, you know, where can I get this or whatever, and I did get out at one point to just, like, point them in the right direction of the triage, but to feel so helpless was really, really hard. And so, anyway, then later after they kind of got the fuselage main part under control, the flames, they pulled up closer so that I was able to be up closer, and then at that point they said I could get out. So that was when I was able to walk around the runway. The money, the mail, the black tape all over, just like a sea of black tape and money like confetti. Things, possessions, people still in their seats who were not alive. I mean, just a lot of images that I can still shut my eyes and picture in my head from what I saw that day. So it was, it was pretty incredible.
The museum's Matt Anderson, who presented the program on the crash of United Flight 232 and its aftermath, said he really wasn't too surprised by the cathartic outpouring at the event.
In hindsight, I do understand it. It was something that hit you right away. I mean, just even as an outside observer to it happening, it was very emotional right away, because you just had a sense of it being such a big event. You know, there were so many people involved, and potentially so many people could have lost their lives, you know, in just one fell swoop. And so that hit you right away. But the people that actually responded to it, it was a scene. The only thing I think I can compare it to is to being in some type of a combat situation or something like that, something very high stress, you know, very violent, where you see things that you're just not ever going to forget. And so, you know, but you still have a job to do, and they had to, you know, of course they were trained to deal with these things, but then they had, you know, a certain character too that allowed them to do what they had to do. And but, you know, it was something that allowed them to have a very positive response in the face of this tragedy, but yet it's something they carry with them then the rest of their lives. And I think there has to be both a pride to it, but then those images that have to be, you know, it's something that's with you all the time.
People were in tears in there. They were talking about children that had died, children who lost their parents. And
you know, I think it's very easy to put yourself in the position of the people that are on the plane. You know, most of us fly at some point or another, and it's always in the back of your mind, I think. At least it's in the back of my mind what could happen. And because there was, you know, families, you know, and kids that lost their lives, it makes it all that much worse. You know, it'd been bad enough if it was, say, a military aircraft or something, you know, where adults had happened to, but it was indiscriminate in that way. And so that made it all the more tragic to us, I think.
There was a man who talked about how there was a saying, the last one out of Sioux City, turn out the lights before this. And this sort of helped us have a better feeling about where we live.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. So the 1970s and 1980s were pretty difficult times economically, in particular in Sioux City. You know, you had the 1970s were generally a downtime, particularly, you know, kind of decline of the manufacturing sector and stuff. But the 1980s, that's the period of the farm crisis. And for instance, the Sioux City stockyards basically collapsed at that time. You know, there were changes in how for the packing industry and things like that that cost Sioux City itself jobs. And you know, there's high unemployment rate here. Of course, you had the high interest rates of the early 80s, which contributed to the farm crisis. And so it had just been really difficult. And a lot of people had left. There wasn't work here, whether it was in construction or in manufacturing. And so Sioux City had kind of lost some population. And there was just a down attitude toward the place in many sectors. And when people had this spontaneous reaction once the crash happened, and you know, were able to you know, swing into action, I don't think there's any doubt the community spirit picked up right away, and really has remained much more positive afterwards ever since. Because I think it gave people a sense of what could be done here, you know, in Sioux City, not and maybe not have to go somewhere else.
That was Matt Anderson of the Sioux City Public Museum. He presented Thursday's History at High Noon on the crash of United Flight 232 30 years ago today at the Sioux Gateway Airport yesterday. Many heroic actions emerged from the crash of Flight 232, including medical professionals on the ground in Sioux City. The most critical patients ended up at Mercy Hospital, and that's where neurosurgeon Dr. Quentin Durwood was waiting in the ER, listening to the tragedy play out. The New Zealand native shared his insight with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer. Here's part of their interview.
The hairs going up on my back as I was listening to this thing and this second-by-second description. And it was within a few minutes of that we got word that there may be survivors, because someone had seen someone come out of the crash. And in fact, the first patient arrived probably, I think, 16 minutes after the crash.
Wow, that's fast.
They had the first patient at Mercy Hospital, and it happened to be a patient that was critically injured. He had a severe head injury, along with other injuries, but he had an immediate CT scan. He was the first one in, and he had a very large blood clot on the brain called a subdural hematoma. And in fact, it was huge. It's a situation like that. You have to make a decision about whether there's any chance he can survive it, because one of the pressure feelings that I recall so vividly there is that, okay, we have one survivor here. It's going to take some time to get that blood clot out, but how many more people are going to be coming in the next minutes, half hour, who are going to perhaps have more chances of survival that could benefit also from surgery? Very fortunately, Dr. Reeder had just got out of surgery, so I know he had a backup. And so I immediately took that patient to surgery. One of the things that is kind of, on reflection, a rather remarkable thing was the leadership and the trauma scene by Dr. Mike Wolpert. Dr. Wolpert was the head of the trauma department at Mercy Hospital, a very wise individual. He had made a decision to manage the initial patient decisions out in the parking lot at Mercy Emergency Room right outside, where he would evaluate the patients. When they came in, he would decide what they were going to do, whether they were going to see a surgeon, whether they were going to get a CT scan, whether they were going to go immediately up the surgery. He made those decisions right there, and he did it extraordinarily well. But he assigned a doctor, a respiratory technician to help manage the airway, and a lab technician to that patient, and they were to stay with that patient constantly. So when I made the decision that I was going to take the patient to surgery, I had one other doctor to help me. It was a family doctor, and as I recall, it was Dr. Mark Taylor, who was a good family physician in Sioux City at the time. So we rushed up to Mercy Surgery. They had everything open, and we immediately started the brain surgery operation. Now, you might think that brain surgery can take hours, and it usually does in elective cases. It takes very careful, but in a super emergency, it's actually possible to open the head in about 5 to 10 minutes and get out a blood clot and get the pressure off the brain. And fortunately, the staff at Mercy were well prepared, and we were able to do a very rapid craniotomy. That's the name of the operation. Got the blood clot out and were able to stop the bleeding, the pressure's off the brain, and that patient has the potential for survival. Mark Taylor, the doctor, was there, but I knew I had to get out because there were other patients out there that were going to need attention. So I gave Mark Taylor a 5-minute lesson in brain surgery closure and told him exactly what had to be done to close that wound over a drain so that the patient was going to be safe to go to intensive care. And so he did that. He did a very good job of it.
Did that patient survive?
That patient did not survive. He lasted for a couple of days and then passed away from the severity of his underlying injury. I was very glad that I had made that decision to do it, because the following day I had had he was an unknown, of course. So many, we didn't know who these people were that came in. Family had finally got hold of the information that he had had this brain surgery, and I was called by a family member and also another neurosurgeon that they knew. And I was able to tell him that, you know, this is what he had, and absolutely everything was done, and he's not going to make it. But he got the best care that possibly could be given to give him a chance. And so that was the result of that.
But you do have other stories where you did have survivors that you worked
most
with.
Most of that, if we look back at that 46 that arrived who were critically ill to Mercy, two of them died in the emergency room. They were unsalvageable. And then two of them died in the next few days of their injuries. One of them was the patient that I operated on. But 42 left the hospital. They were survivors. And given the severity of injury, that was quite a remarkable figure, given the intensity and breadth of these injuries these people had.
Now, I know 5 years ago at the memorial, you actually had a chance to meet one of the flight attendants that you saved.
That's a very complex and very meaningful story to me personally. There was a situation. It was probably about an hour and a half into the disaster, and we'd dealt with a number of people in surgery and in the emergency room, Dr. Rita and I, burn patients, and patients that didn't have what appeared to be supercritical injuries were not managed at Mercy. They had been transferred to St. Luke's Hospital. And there was a passenger, a young woman of Asian descent. When she arrived at St. Luke's, she had a terrible injury to her, I believe, left leg. It had almost been completely severed off. It was bleeding and was dirty. And she was something needed to be done immediately to stem the blood and clean the wound and give her some sort of setting of the fracture. At the time, she was talking. And when she came in, and she was not clinically evaluated to have had a significant head injury. And she was taken to surgery, and when they tried to wake her up from surgery, she was not waking up. She was in a coma, and she had a pupil that had lost its reflex. It was large. Potential here was that she had something very serious happening in her head, like an expanding blood clot. She had a different kind of blood clot called an epidural hematoma. I says, I want you to get her head shaved, take straight back into surgery, and tell them that you need equipment for a craniotomy immediately. So we're an hour and a half, to, or over an hour and a half into it. I says, I've got to go to St. Luke's because this girl is still potentially salvageable, but she's going to die if we don't do something immediately. After surgery, she was in a very, very seriously compromised neurological condition. She was semi-comatose. She was on a breathing machine, really very unresponsive. The subsequent CT scan showed the blood clot was gone, the pressure was off the brain, but there'd been enough pressure that it had caused significant brain dysfunction and brain damage. The issue was whether it was still recoverable or not. And I never knew, because about a week after surgery, she was transferred to a rehabilitation facility in Chicago, as I recall. And I never heard of her after that. I never knew her name because she was a Jane Doe. What happened was is that that case was a case that I had puzzled about for 25 years. And when I went to the 25th anniversary of the crash, which was held 5 years ago, of course, out at the airport, it was this younger, middle-aged lady now, but it was sort of a vague recollection. It looked the same person. And the thing is that when you do a craniotomy, you make an in a situation like that, you make an incision in the head behind the hairline. So it's hidden. So you don't see it on the face or anything. And and she allowed me to part her hair, and there I could see my scalpel incision. Her incision was all healed. And it was this woman, and she was normal. I was absolutely overwhelmed with gratitude, really, that, you know, that she had made it. And she was there with her husband and her daughter. And she actually hadn't been a student. She had actually been a flight attendant, but not working on the flight. She was just transporting on that flight. And when this thing, a terrible thing had happened, and she was actually still employed with United, but now living out in California. And her name was Kathy Tam.
What a story. Now, you were early in your career.
Yes.
Did you expect to stay here in Sioux City, or did this kind of put you on the path of making this your permanent community?
It's a very complex thing. United 232 certainly was an experience which bonded me to this community. You know, the community was fantastic in its response to United 232.
That was neurosurgeon Dr. Quentin Durwood with CNOS. He moved to the Sioux City area just 2 years before Flight 232 from a teaching position at Dartmouth on the East Coast. Neurosurgeon Dr. Ralph Reeder followed Durwood from Dartmouth. Neurosurgeon Dr. Ralph Reeder followed Durwood from Dartmouth after finishing his residency in 1989, and he was only in Sioux City for 3 weeks before the crash. To listen to a longer version of the interview with Dr. Durwood, go to our website, kwit.org. And remember, this weekend, tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing and the first man on the moon. There's plenty of programs out there that celebrate that. Also, some programs out at the Fred G. Dale Planetarium with Dr. Todd Young most of the day tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks also to Sheila Brummer and Steve Smith from Siouxland Public Media. Also, thanks to Matt Anderson at the Sioux City Public Museum. I'm Mary Hartnett. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.